fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strengths, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. One of the many things I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is the precision of the language that we use. All our writings are very clear and direct and leave absolutely no room at all, to my mind, for confusion or ambiguity, which is a considerable achievement considering that they were written for alcoholics. Or maybe that's part of the necessity, maybe that's why the way that they are. But our preamble talks about sobriety as an achievement. It's an important part of our primary purpose, to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And I'm pretty sure there isn't a person in this room tonight that doesn't know what it is to have the achievement of a sober day. So I'm going to ask you to join with me tonight in celebrating our individual and collective achievements. Well, when we're doing so, I think we might also remind ourselves, and anyone who needs reminding, not just that this works, but how wonderfully well and how powerfully it works. Is there anyone in the room tonight that has got 50 years sobriety? Ladies and gentlemen, our first speaker tonight is from the Alive and Surprised group in Surprise, Arizona. Will you please welcome Pam?
I'm Pam McMahon, and I'm an alcoholic. Listen, the first time I said that name, I said McMahon, and my husband said, I'm MacMahon, not McMahon. So anyway, I am so grateful to be here. I am from Surprise, Arizona, which is about 40 miles west of Phoenix. And from what I understand, they got the name by the town founder said, I'll be surprised if anybody ever moves here. Because at that point in time, all there were rattlesnakes and javelinas and some pretty ugly critters. But anyway, I am just so thrilled to be here. You know, I really want to welcome our new friends here. I hope you keep coming back. I hope you stay long enough for the miracle to happen. You know, I'm just going to tell you briefly, because I have 10 minutes, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, when I got here, I was so desperate. I was so afraid that I couldn't stay stopped. I started drinking at a fairly young age, and my blackouts didn't take long before I became a blackout drinker. And I want to tell you, first of all, that my sponsor is sitting here, Polly Pistol, and that my sobriety date is October 3rd, 1978. And when I came to my first meeting in Laguna Beach, California, I had no idea that my whole life was going to be transformed. I had no idea that you were going to give me something I never had. You know, people talk about they've gotten their life back. You gave me a life I never had. You gave me something I never had. I grew up in a very, I'll just have to say it, a very violent family. And most of the violence was on my father's side, and my mother was powerless. I'm the youngest of three girls, and that violence was that twist for me. There were times that I just shut the world out. There are a lot of my childhood I don't remember. That was long before I ever picked up a drink. So when I picked up alcohol, it was the relief, not in the joy of You know, I was a skinny little kid with big ears and these great big eyes, and my sisters just teased me until I would cry. You know, it took the edge off of the pain. I was in so much pain by the time I picked up a drink and I didn't know what it was. I stuffed it inside and I didn't let you know who I was. You know, it's real interesting. My husband called me tonight just to tell me how much he loved me. You know, I've been married now for almost 20 years, and that is a miracle. That is just a miracle. You know, you have enabled me to become a wife, a good wife. You've enabled me to become a good employee. 5 years ago, I retired from a job that I had for 32 years. I could not have maintained employment. They were ready to get rid of me because I couldn't show up. You know, you and the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the ability to deal with, as we talked, the hand that was dealt me, and you gave me a new hand. I'm so grateful to Sandy for that analogy, because I'm a visual person, and along with that being a visual person, I watch what people do. And you said, if I want what you have, do what I do. You know, when I went to that first meeting in Laguna Beach, I watched the women, and it was a women's meeting. I watched the women touching each other with love. I watched them caring about the new person. I watched them being accountable. And I watched them walk with dignity. I had lost all my self-respect. I had lost all my dignity. I had lost everything that was important to me. Now, these are not outside things, because I still had a job. I still had a watch. You know, I still had a car. You know, and I was told to put yets on those things that hadn't happened to me yet. Because alcoholism is a deadly, fatal disease. And so many times I'm reminded of how alcoholism kills people who don't even have the disease. I was a blackout drinker and I drove all the time. It is by God's grace that I'm standing here and not in a prison. It is by God's grace that I am standing here and not in a grave. You know, I am so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous has spread all over the world. You have welcomed us like we are family that you just hadn't met yet. You know, for the new people, I hope you embrace Alcoholics Anonymous and keep coming back, just no matter what is happening in your life, and find someone who has a little more time than you and share a little bit about who you are. I was so secretive. I lived in a family of secrets. And I was told at a very early age, don't you ever tell people about what's going on in our home. And you allowed me to become vulnerable. You've allowed me to become transparent. And you've allowed me to become who I am today. And you know, I got just a lovely gift from a new friend that I met. And it brought tears to my eyes, because what you have given me is the ability to love you and to take love in. And I couldn't do that. You know, alcohol only took the edge off for me unless I was in a blackout. Alcohol took me a lot of places I didn't want to go. And now Alcoholics Anonymous is taking me a lot of places I do want to go. You know, I am so grateful to be here. You know, that job that I retired from, I have the travel benefits that were left with that job. So it enabled me to come over here and spend some time with my sponsor and meet some new friends. You know, I will be forever grateful. And the new people, this thing really works. I was told that I could stay sober no matter what. I was told that no matter what was going on in my life, that these 12 steps, the traditions and the concepts and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we can do what I can't. You know, I couldn't change. I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stay stopped. But you know, it's by God's grace that I have had some time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so grateful. And with that, you know, I can hardly wait to hear Sandy tonight. I'm going to quit sharing, but thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, our main speaker tonight has come all the way from a Saturday Night Fever group in Tampa, Florida. Would you please welcome Sandy Beach?
Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How y'all doing? You know, when they do those sobriety countdowns, back in the States, everybody stands up and then they start having you sit down. And I noticed something about the sobriety countdowns. The person who's the last one with the most time, next thing that happens, they die. So, makes me real nervous to be the one with the most sobriety, you know. They're going, so I'm starting to sit down at 25 years, so they won't see me up there, because I'm not ready for the big meeting in the sky yet. I just want to clarify something. When I say that this is not an I program, but a we program, I don't mean that it's a little tiny program. Anyway, I'm here tonight to talk about the 12 steps. I don't know where it's going to go. I never have a plan, but I always have fun. And so I'm just going to set the stage with a couple of things. One of the books that's mentioned in the big book is The Variety of Religious Experiences by William James. And it's referenced in the spiritual definition of spiritual experience in the back of the book. Now, when I was about a year sober, I got a hold of that book, and it was too hard to read with that little sobriety, because this guy was an amazing writer. He was sort of a PhD, William James. He's the father of American psychology. And went to Harvard, and he spoke about five languages, and when he writes, he's referencing Greek things and Roman things and four different languages, so you got to really work hard to plow through it. And it turns out that it isn't really a book after all. It is simply a bound volume of a series of about 17 lectures that he gave at the University of Edinburgh, Scotland, in the late 1800s, when he was invited over here as the guest emeritus professor, you know, with all of the learned European scholars. And he had been assigned the assignment, in other words, his topic was, of what value has religion been to mankind? Now, the stuff that we're familiar with is the two types of spiritual experiences that he talks about, the sudden kind that Bill has, and then the more garden variety educational type. But it's very interesting what he had to say about religion. His conclusion at the end of all these lectures was that religion had done about as much good as it had harm. And that in the final analysis, it really didn't contribute anything to mankind. Now, that's a pretty big indictment, you know, of this study. But he found one beautiful spot. The one exception was, because of religion, individuals had spiritual experiences. And those people that had the spiritual experiences contributed mightily to the human race. I could name Bill Wilson. I could name Frank Buchman, started the Oxford movement. So in other words, the greatest value that can be, that he found, that could be a contribution to the well-being of the world is the spiritual experience itself, because the transformation of the individual starts affecting people around that individual, and it starts changing them, and then they can help, and it goes on and on. So I just wanted to throw that out. It's a way of sort of setting the stage. And the second thing that I wanted to throw out was everybody's read the, or most people, if you've been around AAY, you've read the letters between Bill Wilson and Dr. Carl Jung. When Roland Hazard went over to see Dr. Jung and saw him for a year, and he did everything he could to transform his personality, but when he left, he went to drinking right away and came back, and Dr. Jung said, "There's nothing I can do for you." And every time I read that, I think about the ABCs at the end of chapter, or the stuff we read about chapter 5, A, where alcoholic couldn't manage our own lives, and then B, no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And I think of Dr. Jung looking at Roland Hazard, and certainly Dr. Jung represented all there was in terms of human power, and that human power looked and said, with all humility, "There's nothing I can do for you." Now, how about that? And that was the most wonderful thing that you can say to an alcoholic. Because what does it induce when you are told there's nothing that can be done for you? It induces desperation. And that, of course, is the only way in to this program, is to get desperate. Anyway, at the end of his letter, when he talks about, I love his definition of alcoholism, is that alcoholics have an inordinate longing for God. Not a bad definition. And that we just were uncomfortable in our old skin, and we always knew there was something missing, and we always knew that I just can't seem to fix whatever's wrong inside of me, and alcohol appeared to fix it because drinking is very similar to a spiritual experience. It is causing the world to look wonderful when by a power that comes inside of us. And so I just always liked that particular definition. But later on, he's just discussing life in general. Now, this is Carl Jung. I was reading an old Time magazine article. It's about 50 years old. Somebody just gave me a copy of it. And Carl Jung was on the cover. And they asked him in the middle of the article, "Do you believe in God?" And he said, "No, I don't believe in God. I know there is a God." In other words, he had that much assurance in his own life, which is what happens when you have this awakening or this contact, or as I was saying the other night, when your finger is stuck in the light socket, you suddenly know electricity. You know what I'm talking about? And so that's what happened to him. But then he was talking about mankind in general. And he said, mankind is faced with the struggle against evil. Now, he uses the word evil. We use the word character defects. But we know what we're talking about. It's that struggle that goes on inside of us. And he says, and mankind always loses. Always loses. With one exception. And this is why, you know, it's so funny. You come right back with one exception. And that exception has two parts. One is that the person has a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening. But that's not sufficient because that can fade. The second crucial part is that they belong to a society that helps them maintain the spiritual awakening. How about a definition of Alcoholics Anonymous? I mean, there it is. A place where we are led through a sponsor, through a series of actions that we don't believe in, Nobody believes in the steps ahead of time. You ever read those? Hey, that looks good to me. I remember looking at the steps going, where's the money step? I mean, you know, my problem was money. I didn't, well, this stuff looked all, what has that got to do with anything? So if you've been studying the steps and not seeing anything there, that's right. You won't see a thing by studying the steps. They only become visible after we do them. Then they become visible. Kind of like drinking. What if someone said to you when you were sick, can I take this off? I'm getting hot already. What if somebody said to you when you were 16 and you were afraid to dance, and they said, Harry, don't worry about it. See this glass with this dark liquid in it? You drink this drink, you will know how to dance. It's the same as 12 Arthur Murray lessons. So you picked up the glass and you went, if I drink this, I'll know how to dance. Yeah, just drink it. Now, what if you didn't drink it? What if you never drank? To this day, you would swear that that wouldn't have worked. How could a glass of some kind of brown liquid cause you to know how to dance? Well, you're not familiar with the power of alcohol. And that's the same thing with the power that's available in this program. My sponsor got me started. It's not by accident that, what does it take, about 60 pages in the big book to discuss step one? I mean, you get through all through Bill's story and more about alcoholism, and it just goes on and on. Now, why is it so important that we understand step one? Why is that the secret to the whole spiritual program? It's because we tend to minimize our own situation. We have no idea how much trouble we're in. And I remember after I'd been sober about 3 months, and my sponsor said, why don't you really level... Now, I'm wearing a wristband from a nut ward, and I've been locked up in there for a long time. And I've been very sick with alcohol poisoning and malnutrition and all of that, but it's not that bad. And he asked me, he said, Sandy, why don't you finally level with me about how bad it's been? You got to just be honest with somebody. So I started almost crying. I said, well, the more I think about it, goes all the way back. And I, oh, thank you. I treated my mother so badly when I started drinking, and then all of my friends, and blah, 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 went on and on and on. And then I had a grand mal seizure. I had malnutrition. I'm losing my career in the Marine Corps. Everything, well, it's just, And his only comment was, you know, if you keep drinking, it's really going to get bad. And that was what he was trying to induce in me, is this attitude of desperation. Because we're being asked to give up, as we enter the spiritual world, one of our most precious possessions, and that is our own better judgment. I mean, how many times do you ask to do something? Well, in my opinion, I don't think an inventory is what I need. I think, and we're saying, yeah, but we want you to give that up. We want you to give up, and we're going to guide you through your life. Is that okay? You don't have anything to say about it anymore. That's a hard thing to give up. I don't have anything to say about it anymore. That's right. We'd like you to turn over all of this stuff. Whoa. Now, if we turn that all over, we'll be nobody, and our ego does not want to be nobody. So the struggle that goes on throughout all of the steps and all of this is the struggle between our ego and our spiritual nature. This is the great epic battle they've been writing about for thousands of years. It's, can a human conquer himself? Turns out he can't, or she can't. It can't be done without help. That's the fallacy of the thinking that you can accomplish things on our own. We can only go so far, and then we fail. Unless we can get the humility to ask for help. And how hard is it to ask for help? Somebody was talking to Polly, pick up the 60-pound phone. You know what I mean? It's so hard to ask for help. So to help us along, we have to get desperate. We have to get there. So anyway, I'd been sober about 5 or 6 months, and mostly go to meetings, don't drink, put the plug in the jug, go to meetings, put the plug in the jug, go to meetings. That was the old timers in Washington, D.C. And now comes time, we're going to have to start talking about the spiritual part of the program. Well, there's only one part of the program, the spiritual part of the program. There's no non-spiritual part. At least that I've never read about. I haven't read the, here's the non-spiritual part back here. And so he sat me down and he said, Sandy, I just want to ask you a few questions, sort of get a sense, sort of a spiritual inventory of you. I said, okay, yep, I'm ready now to be honest, you know what I mean? He said, how much do you pray? I said, how much do I pray? Listen, I had this terrible thing with the Catholic Church when I was young. All that stuff is crap. I don't pray. During the Lord's Prayer at the meetings, I hum. I don't like prayer. I don't like the word prayer. I'm not interested in prayer, and I probably never intend to pray. So put me down, zero prayer. That's it. Zero prayer. Okay, zero prayer. Do you spend much time in church? In there where there's the wonderful spiritual energy and where you can hear guidance as to making our lives better? Any time in church? No, Bill, I had the bad experience when I was young. That place sucks. When I'm walking around Washington, D.C., and there's a church on the block, I go around the block. I don't even want to see the church from the outside, and I certainly don't want to go in the inside. And if these meetings weren't in the basement of the church, I wouldn't come to the meetings. So he said, zero church. Yep, zero church, zero church. Now, one other thing that people do, Sandy, is they sit and contemplate. Meditation. A way of letting go, sitting quietly, allowing the energy of the universe to come in. How much of that do you do? I said, Bill, zero, zero, zero. I'm not interested in it. I think it's all mumbo jumbo. No, zero, no meditation, nothing, nothing. Okay, all right. Now, there's a whole section in bookstores on spirituality, New Age, and there's just this whole trend of thought to enable people to lift out of themselves. Do you spend any time at all looking into any of that? I said, no, I don't. I like mysteries, I like history. Mostly I like sports. I like football, and that's it. So zero. And then he asked the biggest spiritual question of all. After giving him four zeros, he said, so how's it going? And I went, awful. And then he said, see all these people that are happy in AA? Well, they're praying, they're meditating, they're considering churches, they're reading spiritual things. And that glow you see inside of them is what happens when you do that. So we're getting down to when Bill writes, spirituality is intensely practical. We're not talking about theories. We're talking about results. So there you are, Mr. Four Zeros. And you're going down the tubes. Here's these people who used to have four zeros, and they were willing to reconsider and change their mind, and look at them, a program of attraction. We don't explain anything. It's not a theory. The big book says that. Spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. It has to be the way that we are living. So I had to concede that he did have a little bit of a point. And that he had me scared about the disease, that I suddenly realized that if I went back, I was going to not make it. You know what I mean? So I was willing to allow this man to become part of my decision-making process. That was about as far as I was going to go, but I still had veto power. I wasn't completely giving him control. And so that was about where I was on step one. Right there. Pretty good. I mean, I was almost 100%, and you got to really get to 100% to make the program work. Any reservations is going to ruin the entire rest of the stuff. You know, you can talk to somebody who's been sober for 5 years and they're not happy. They're wondering why. Well, I've done an inventory. I've done this. I've done that. What's wrong? What's wrong? They never surrendered 100%. There was a little bit being held back, that my case is just a little bit different. I'm not quite as screwed up as those guys on that side of the room, and I'm not as arrogant as those people over there. I'm almost 100% powerless. 99.1. That'll kill you. That'll kill you. If we don't have a fatal disease and understand it, then we're not going to take the tremendous effort that it takes to wrestle the control of our lives away from ourselves and turn it over, so that we can be guided through the rest of our lives instead of figuring anything out at all, which is the whole point of the program. The point of the program is to have the spiritual experience, you, yourself, personally, and you just have this wonderful thing. Now, the things that I say are just my opinion. I hope you understand that. This is where I see everything with where I am right now in the program. And so if your sponsor said, well, don't listen to that, don't listen to it. Don't bother me. Because I have my own view on a lot of things, and you'll hear some of them later on. I'll give you one right now. I believe that the spiritual experience that Bill had and that most of the people I talk to in AA has two parts. One is the tremendous freedom from alcohol and the problems that are consuming us, and an awareness that this happened because of our own Creator. That's one. And the second thing that comes with it, it's part of it, is the desire to pass it on. You cannot hold it. It's just, it hit Bill while he's in the freaking hospital. Well, I'll start a world program. We'll get this to everybody. You know what I mean? It's just, so these two things go together. Now, the reason I'm giving you that is, it really upset me that they adopted I Am Responsible, whenever it was in 1980. What do we need that for? It's already there. It's like saying you guys are falling down. There's a guy who wants help, and you're going, no thanks, I don't feel like helping you. You can't, if the spiritual awakening took place, you cannot resist helping. There's just absolutely not. And if the spiritual awakening hasn't taken place, what are you going to pass on? So I'm just throwing my own opinion in there. That's all right. So anyway, my sponsor's going, oh, and here's another thing. These things just occur to me from time to time. How do you become a believer? How do you become a non-believer? You're talking about the hand, the deal, or play the cards that are dealt to you. And people come up to me and they say, how come you're happy all the time? I say, it's my job. That's my job. I was assigned that job, so I have to do that. Happiness is a decision. Believing in God is a decision. Not believing in God was a decision. You follow what I'm saying? There was nobody showed up. God didn't come down and go, I don't exist, so don't believe in me. Oh, okay. You just decided someday when you were 15, I don't believe. That's all crap. It doesn't mean it's true. So what do we compare? You compare a life where you decide not to believe, and then you come to AA and we say, okay, we want you to now decide to believe and then compare it. and see which works better. You see what I'm saying? There's no great big deal here. You're still in charge of analyzing the results. That's your job. Once you turn your life over to AA, your job, every 3 months you report in. Is it better or worse? And what happens every 3 months? Hey, it's even better. It's even better. It's even better. Well, then I guess your decision to believe in a higher power was a good one for you. Yes, it was. So the decision to believe is what creates the whole program. And that's... So my sponsor's trying to get me to change my decision. You follow what I'm saying? Which was, I don't believe in this. It's all... And he pointed out, well, how's that working? And I went, oh, it's working awful. That was, he was saying, you know what I mean? We can, when we, before we come here, we can be the smartest person in the world. We can win debates. We can crush people and prove the non-existence of this, blah, 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 blah. But we're still not happy. Our own theory is not making us happy. And so my sponsor would tell me, look, Sandy, if you're going to write a book, don't put your picture on the front. Because no one will buy it. You look miserable. You are so unhappy. You know what I mean? How to have a wonderful life. And so you may have a wonderful theory. You may be able to espouse all kinds of knowledge. But your face gives you away. There isn't the inner peace that's in so many faces that you see in Alcoholics Anonymous. There is the proof. So it's very, very practical. It isn't an abstract theory. So how do we get? This is, to me, this is the big moment now. If you're new, we're going to come into the getting spiritual part. This is the revival part. Okay, here we go. Only kidding. And you're never going to guess where they hid the spiritual part. The most spiritual transforming part of the entire program is in the chapter of the agnostic. How about that for a sense of humor, huh? When I was given the big book, I didn't read it. I mean, I scanned it, and I said, oh, man, give me a break. I got to get money. I got money, money. That was what I have 6 kids, and they're starving. I can't earn any money. Money, money. And, you know, they're... Bills are coming. You know, yeah, everybody knows that. Where's the money step? The money, the money. The job step, the job step. I'll get to this peace of mind inventory, blah, 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 blah. Because you got to have some money in your pocket to do any of this stuff. It's just... But time moves on. We got to get spiritual. You know what I mean? So here I am. So here it is. And I get the big book and I go... Well, I'll skim through, look around. I remember I knew he was going to check to see if I read it, so I bent the pages up. I got a magic marker. I went, whoop, 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 whoop. Wow, you know. I even put some coffee stains from a coffee cup. Let a cigarette burn out on the page. So if you look at my book, you'd go, man, this guy is really a student of the book. When I was going through the book, I saw a chapter of the agnostic, and I went, there it is. That's my baby. And I knew, without reading it, I knew what was in there. A lot of us know how to do that. That was the chapter where the agnostics are shown how to stay sober. Obviously, they're staying sober without the steps and all this prayer stuff. So I knew I'd end up in the chapters of the agnostic if I ever read it. Well, when you read it, big surprise. The entire chapter can be summarized in 3 words. Change your mind. Oh, you're an agnostic? Well, forget it. Become a former agnostic. Bad decision. Bad decision. Won't get you anywhere. So, if you're new, we're in the middle of the chapter, the beginning of the chapter of the agnostic, and we're getting ready for you right now to get spiritual, okay? And this is how it's done. Here's the sentence. If, now listen closely if you're new. If when you drink, you have little control over the amount you drink. Okay, that's everybody. And if when you stop, you can't stay stopped. Okay, that's everybody. You're in so far? Then you're probably an alcoholic. So there's our definition of alcoholism. If when you drink, you have a little control over the amount you drink, and if you stop, you can't stay stopped, boom, you're all in. You're all with me so far. Good, because here comes the next sentence. If that be the case, you're suffering from a disease that only a spiritual experience can conquer. Would you like to hear that again? I remember hearing that, like, what the hell kind of disease is that? I never had a doctor tell me, well, see that rash? Only a spiritual experience can get rid of that rash. I didn't know they had diseases that only a spiritual experience can get rid of. And there it was. You got a disease that only a spiritual experience can get rid of. So I looked at my sponsor and I said, I don't believe in spiritual experience. He said, well, you're screwed. We don't have a non-spiritual way of saving your life. You don't? Whoa. And now they're hammering it in. They're ready for the close. If you're a salesman, now we're ready for the close. Because the next paragraph, to be doomed an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. You know, that's a comedy line. So let me help you. If you're new, come on up on the stage. We'll make it into a quiz program. I got two doors behind me. I'm the master of ceremony. Nancy, come on up here. Okay, Nancy, you got to choose one of these doors. This is your future. Everybody's watching. Do you want to die an alcoholic death? Door number one. Do you want to live on a spiritual basis? Door number two. If you are a typical alcoholic, this is what you do. Whoa. Oh. Is there door number three somewhere? Oh, my God. Oh. Do I get a phone call? Yes, you get a phone call. You get a phone call. Hello, Dr. Miller. This is Nancy. A friend of mine would like to know, how bad is an alcoholic death? Oh, Jesus. I'll take the spiritual basis. That's how we get spiritual. You see what I'm talking about? We were just made an offer that we can't refuse. Nobody believes in that at this point. The reality, the truth of our situation is just laid out right in front of us. And we just go, there doesn't appear to be a choice here. Bobby was talking about that. The parachute, there's an old story about a kid who grew up and his father was a parachute packer, a rigger, and an alcoholic. And he used to watch his father putting parachutes together, and he's hitting it with his elbow, having a drink, laughing, doing the strings wrong and everything. And he asks, what is that for? Oh, people jump out of airplanes, and then this opens, theoretically, and it saves their life. And so with that childhood experience, he knew he would never jump out in a parachute. I mean, no way is he going to jump out of the plane. I mean, that's the end of that story right there. Until years later, he's in the military, the plane, the engine's quitting, the sergeant's handing out the parachutes. He says, I don't believe in those. This would be a good time to change your mind. This would be a good time to change your mind. This is where we are when we come to the second step. We just pushed him out of the plane. We go, hey, a spiritual experience might save you. Why don't you ask for God's help? And as we're coming down, we might yell out, please help me, even though we don't believe in it. You see what I'm saying? It was circumstances rather than any virtue that caused us to make that decision to go ahead with the spiritual part of the program. There was no other place to go. And unless we went through this experience, and if we didn't go through it, it may look like the spiritual part is optional. You follow what I'm saying? And unless it's desperate, we're not going to do the ego-crushing work. So anytime you're stalled, go back and see. Maybe you've rewritten steps 1 and 2 for yourself and given yourself a milder case of alcoholism that doesn't require the painful reduction of our own egos. And so I just set that all up with those steps, because with that in mind, we make a decision. Now we're going to make a decision that the only way out of my problem is spiritual, so I might as well see how good I can do with this. So I'm making a decision to turn my entire life over to this spiritual program. At that point, it may be our sponsor, AA itself, or whatever, but it is a big decision. Now, nothing gets turned over at that point. It's kind of like making a decision to go to graduate school and get a degree in engineering. When you make the decision, you don't have any degree. You've just decided to do a lot of work. And that's what we decide in step 3, is that I'm going to take whatever it takes to turn my life over. See, I thought I could just run upstairs. I do everything in front of a mirror in the bedroom. That's where I try to be spiritual. And so I'd run up and I'd look in the mirror and I'd get the spiritual look that I saw in a movie once. And I'd go, "You got it, God." And then I'd come back down, didn't feel like he took it. It doesn't get turned over in the third step. The decision to turn it over, it can't be turned over because we have 1,000 character defects that are grabbing. And we got to loosen every one of them. It's as if we were living in the gutter and we decide to leave the gutter, but there's 100 ropes holding us there. So we can decide to leave and we can start cutting them. But until we cut the last one, we're still in the gutter. You follow what I'm saying? So this decision is a decision to do the rest of the steps. And then it's explained to us. And by the way, I'll just throw this out. When I sponsor people, this is my own system. I use simultaneously the Big Book and the 12 and 12. And then we come and we meet once a week for an hour, hour and a half in the very, very beginning. And we do take, an hour on step 1. And I give them the reading assignment ahead of time. And then we come over and they've read all the stuff in the Big Book. And then step 1 and the 12 and 12. And I try to work, put it all together, because there's tremendous value. Granted, the Big Book is the main one, but there's stuff in the 12 and 12s that's so awesome. God, 10 is just unbelievable. And so I use both books together. Some people just use the Big Book, but this is what I do. And in general, it's a week on this step, and then come back a week later, we got on this one. 4 takes a little longer, and 5 is just a week, and then 8 and 9 can take longer. But in general, 15, 20 weeks, it's all done. That's my pace at working through the steps and seeing if we can't have this spiritual awakening, that sense of realization that your own creator is now in touch with you. And to me, that's the whole point of sponsoring somebody, is so that that happens. And then that's what they pass on to the next person. So one of the nice things about the 12 and 12 is it sets us up for the how to do it in the Big Book, is the wonderful discussion of the origin of our character defects, which we're going to inventory, very well laid out in the Big Book. But over in the 12 and 12, it says, well, let's look at these things. What are all these character defects that we're beating ourselves up about? They're instinctual drives. That's what they are. And everybody has the same amount. When you arrive on the planet, boom, boom, out you come, and you got the sex drive, the security drive, and the place in society. And those are born in us so that we will reproduce, so that we will form a society, and that we will achieve some sort of security. Those are all part of just being a human being. So when we feel these drives, they make us uncomfortable, and they're very necessary for us to survive. But without a spiritual view, man, I can't sleep. I'm worried about money. I'm worried about money. You got to go get money. You have the sexual drive. You got to go get sex. I mean, it's just,
You have to meet the demands. That's the only formula that a person could possibly see from the inside out until we get to AA. And we find out it's possible to reduce the demands spiritually and have peace of mind without getting anything. Because they're not supposed to be in charge of us. They aren't supposed to be the masters of our lives, but they are if we're trying to control them ourselves. And our ego wants us to control it ourselves, and we just keep going. If I had a bigger car, if I had a yacht, if I had that, I know I'd feel better. I know. And it's a midlife crisis for alcoholic and non-alcoholic. Is it the guy or the gal in the big house with the two cars and the three kids contemplating suicide? What happened? What happened? I got it all. And I still feel terrible. There's still something missing. There's something wrong with me. I can't get comfortable. And so I find that very helpful in the 12 and 12 to see this discussion of what these drives are. And it's not your fault that you have lust. It's not your fault that you're trying to strive for this. It's not your fault. That was just the way you were born. What was left out is we need spiritual power to give us peace of mind. So that's the point of doing the steps, is to enable us to get in touch with this power that can reduce these demands. But first we have to inventory them. That's what this is all about. It's an honest analysis. What is it? What is this? What is this? And so with that in mind, it eliminates a lot of guilt. A lot of us feel guilty about our character defects. Why am I doing this? Why am I so selfish? Why can't I set up a moral code for myself and live up to it? You can't. You can't rise above yourself on your own. You can't become spiritual without a higher power. And so, like Dr. Jung is saying, we're always going to lose when we try to overcome ourselves on our own. And that was the frustration of not being able to live up to our own standards. And as the drinking went on, we just kept lowering the standards. Well, maybe I can live up to this. Well, no, I can't do that. Lower it, lower it, lower it. Remember that? And geez, it really got awful. And you felt so terrible about yourself. So I think reading in the 12 and 12 helps with that. Then in the main thing of the fifth step of sharing all of this with someone else, not only does it finally bring us out from hiding and handling all these secrets on our own and the great freedom that we get from that, but we learn one of the greatest lessons in the world. It's impossible to see the truth about ourselves alone. In other words, when you fill out a four-step sheet and you got rationalization on there, how do you know that anything on there is worth anything? It could be all crap. You follow what I'm saying? So how do you check this out? How do you validate everything that you wrote? You run it by somebody else. You run it by somebody else. The third dimension appears when we look at it through two sets of eyes. It's like a 3D movie. You need two projectors. And the old scopes, you remember that with the postcards? And you looked in there and, oh, you saw the third dimension. And that's what a fifth step does. We suddenly see the third dimension of our own lives. And this we thought was important wasn't important. Over here, we're overlooking something. And, geez, our sponsor goes, boy, this is really, we've got to dig more into this. We just don't have an accurate appraisal of ourselves by ourselves. I once heard a speaker say, my story is divided into two parts. What happened during the years that I drank and what I thought happened during the years that I drank. Entirely different things. What I thought happened. And so out of this, what I think is so wonderful, we get to the beginning of humility. And we also establish a new lifetime practice of always bouncing stuff off of someone else. I do that 10 times a day. Anytime some little upsetting situation, I just, hey, Dan, let me run something by. I'm talking about a 20-second phone call. Somebody came in, blah, 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 blah. Then I got upset, and I said, what do you think? He said, I think you owe him an amend. Okay, boom. You follow what I'm saying? You take care of disturbances in 20, 30 seconds. if you pick up the phone that fast. The difference between a new person and an old timer is the old timer picks the phone up right away. New person waits a week or so, figuring they could handle it on their own. And by that time, it's enormous. A little slight at the office now requires a gun. You know what I mean? Oh, but at least I'm not asking for help. Just so you know, wow, I can't be asking for help. Then comes a couple of steps. And I'm slight and I may not get through everything, but I'll do the best I can. Then comes a couple of steps that are just huge in the 12 and 12. And, geez, I think I could talk all night on just 6 and 7, but I'm going to give you a couple of thoughts that I've had lately. We're entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of character. What's a problem with that step? There's some serious problems with that step when you read it. Number one, if all my character defects were gone, I'd be perfect. Is this step suggesting perfection? What about progress, not perfection? How about most? That would be better, wouldn't it? We're entirely ready to have God remove most of my character defects. All of my character defects. And then God remove them. How about we're entirely ready to work hard on our character defects? You know what happens when you get God involved? He's very extreme. He's very extreme. See what he did to our drinking? Boom, gone. No drinking. Out, gone. You want that with all the rest of your character defects? Are you sure? In step 6, Bill calls this the riddle of our existence. Having been granted a perfect release from alcohol because we were entirely ready to have this removed, why can't we do that with the rest of our character defects? Why aren't we all perfect? It obviously works as soon as you get entirely ready. And humbly ask, so why do we still have them all? And that's Bill's going, well, that's the riddle. It may only exist in the mind of God, the real answer. But possibly it's this. Drinking was fatal. The rest of the character defects aren't like drinking was. And even our ego could go along with getting rid of drinking so that it could continue to screw with us and with all the other character defects. Because if we died, it would have no role to play whatsoever. So it was able to achieve 100% willingness with respect to the alcohol, but what about the rest? And then Bill, that's great discussion, the 12 and 12, about all the other character defects. And how, even though we'd like to get rid of them in the abstract, wouldn't you love to be character defect? Oh, yes, I would. It's kind of like in the States, we go, wouldn't you like a balanced budget? Oh, yeah, I want a balanced budget. Good, I'll raise your taxes. And we go, wait a minute, no. Or I'll cut your favorite program. No. I don't want it really balanced. I want it semi-balanced. So when it comes at us, let's discuss the 7 deadly sins. See if we're ready to get rid of them all. You ready? Okay, let's start with lust. Everybody wants to get rid of 100% of lust. Raise your hand. Okay, no hands. You want to get rid of most lust. Am I right or wrong? What would zero lust be? Okay, I got zero lust. What is that? Dead? What? Doesn't that sound extreme to you? Zero lust? So I'm sitting there and I'm going, put me down for 50%. I want a 50% reduction in lust. Okay? The only problem with that, Sandy, you got to achieve that on your own. God won't help you reduce lust by 50%. It's all or nothing. Oh, Jesus. Well, let's go on the next one. What about pride? Oh, yeah, I want to get rid of false pride. No, you want to get rid of all the pride. Pride. I was in the Marine Corps. Pride's very important. It heads the list. Well, I mean, you know, get rid of pride. What is that, a communist organization? I mean, what do you mean, get rid of pride? Pride's very important. And I struggled with that. And my sponsor challenged me to find a sentence that I could use pride in that would be spiritually sound. And I couldn't. It was all connected to me. You thought, well, I'm so proud my son hit a home run in the Little League. You know what I really meant? Hey, everybody, look at me. I'm the father of the kid that hit the home run. If it hadn't been for me, he wouldn't hit the home run. So actually, I get the credit for the home run. I'm so proud. That's what pride means. We come in AA and we go, I'm so grateful my son hit a home run with his God-given talents. Ah, now we're giving credit somewhere else. So it's a transfer of all these characters. I don't want to get rid of all my pride. How about gossip? Oh, yeah, gossip. Dr. Bob talked about it ruining AA, blah, 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 all of that. I went, you're right. Yeah, gossip. Got to go. I got to go. I'm off of gossip. And then I go, God damn, there's some of those stories are so cool. I'll tell you what. I'm going to stop originating gossip. But if it starts over there, I'm just a conduit as it's passing through. That's possibly, technically, not gossip. So put me down for eliminating originating gossip. And then we start, I don't care which one you want to do, greed. You want to get rid of all greed? Yeah, I won't care if I don't have anything. And then part of me is going, what? What did you just say? You want, what? Let's get it down. Let's get rid of 80%. We'll get rid of 80%. And you see, it's pretty hard to want anything removed 100%. That is hard. That's really hard. There was a story that I'd like to tell about the sixth. I may never get through all of these. About the sixth step that C.S. Lewis wrote. Wonderful little story about the dilemma that we face in the sixth step. It was a little boy, he's like 11 years old, he's a baseball player in grammar school. And the big game is tomorrow, and the coach said, Johnny, I don't want you to think about baseball, I don't want you nothing. All I want tonight is 8 hours sleep. Tell your mother you want to go to bed early and get 8 hours sleep. You do that, we're going to win. So he goes home, tells his mother, I've got to go to bed early, I want to get 8 hours sleep. Okay, give him the food, boop, gets in bed, sound asleep. About 1 o'clock in the morning, he feels a little toothache starting. You know how you get that tingle, tingle? And he knows if he calls his mother and asks for 2 aspirin, she'll give him 2 aspirin, he's asleep, same as if he slept all the way through. But he doesn't call his mother. He's going to wait and see if it'll go away by itself. And he's waiting, and you know, 3 minutes later, oh, it's a little bit worse. But it still could go away by itself, and I won't have to ask my mother for the aspirin. He wrestles with this decision for 2 hours before he finally calls her. She gives him the 2 aspirin, and he goes back to sleep. So the question is, why did he wait 2 hours? What the heck is wrong with this kid? What was wrong with him was that he knew his mother, and he knew that she wouldn't stop with the 2 aspirin. It would be followed by a dental appointment. And then when we went to the dentist wouldn't stop with that little tingling. While we're here, we're going to check your whole mouth. And if we find a few other cavities, we're going to have a series of appointments until we have perfect teeth. He didn't want perfect teeth. He wanted 2 aspirin. The only help that was available was perfect help. And that's our problem. When we're dealing with our higher power, the only help that's available is perfect help. And so we struggle trying to do this ourselves. I heard the speaker say this, there's an old saying in AA, I can't, God can, let him. You ever hear that one? I can't, God can. Well, he had a different take on it, and it went like this. I can't, God can. On second thought, maybe I can. That's called almost turning it over. You know what I mean? It was a step in the right direction. So there is the why step 6 is a lifetime job. We're going to have to continue to try and achieve the willingness to surrender more and more parts of our lives. And more we surrender, the happier we're going to be. And that's the struggle between our ego and our spiritual side. And then in the 7th step, we run into a very 4-letter word that nobody likes. It's called pain. right there in the 12 and 12, he ruins the whole step. We got this thing about humility and all of that, and then it says, getting rid of the ego is very painful, and we're going to have to deal with that. Now, why would it be painful? Well, when you think of the problems that human beings can have, you can condense them all into one. At least I think you can. Not getting your way. It comes in many fashions. It could be sexual, it could be money, it could be a promotion, it could be whatever it is. And the reason you're in are upset is because things aren't going your way. You follow what I'm saying? And here's step seven. We're going to try and get rid of our way entirely. You see what I'm saying? I'm going to humbly ask God to remove all of this so that I am no longer in charge of anything. Well, we already know ahead of time, every time something is taken out, we're going to give it up. It's going to hurt as we shrink the ego. The difference is, when we were drinking, we were suffering as we went to the gutter. It was a painful experience to go down the tubes. You know, all of us know that. But this way, we're going to go up. And humility shows us that what looks like suffering produces wonderful results. And since it starts producing wonderful results, it kind of takes the pain away. It reminds me, if you're out of shape and you want to get back in shape, it's pretty painful to start with, right? When you go down the gym, now you're going to do the bike, now you're going to do this, now you're over here on the treadmill. Oh boy, all the muscles hurt. But after you get in shape, it's just effort. It's just no longer painful. And the same thing applies in this spiritual realm. It may seem painful, but as soon as you experience the joy of having it lifted out, the pain is forgotten, much as the pain of childbirth may be forgotten with the joy of seeing the new baby. And when something is totally removed, we are seeing a new person being born right in front of our eyes, and it's us. That's the transformation. So now we're at the last things before we can live a day at a time. The tenth step is where we live a day at a time. We got two more steps that are dealing with the past, which is the list of the people we'd harmed and the making of the amends. And again, in the 12 and 12, it's a wonderful discussion of what harm is. It just goes through all these things that we may have forgotten. And it helps us see how we affect the world that we live in. And Bill writes a wonderful word in there that I've loved ever since I read it, how to live in harmony with the people around us. How to live in harmony. It's as if there's a master musician writer in the sky who produces a score for all of us to follow. And if we play the notes that are written by the master composer, there'll be nothing but harmony. There'll be nothing but harmony. And we can, as we get rid of our self-centeredness, we can start living in harmony and playing notes that are in harmony with the situations that we face. In simple things, I'm talking about when you go to the dry cleaners to pick up your suit that you're going to wear to the wedding and they tell you they lost it. Now, one response is, you go, oh my God, this poor girl is the clerk here. She had nothing to do with losing it. The company lost it. She is shaking in her boots knowing what I'm going to say when my suit isn't ready for my daughter's wedding. But instead of doing that, I'm going to calm her down. I'm going to use this opportunity to go, young lady, don't worry about it. I got to wear something else. We'll get it next week. You just relax. Can you imagine doing that? You could. Why not? Why do I have to just blow up because I don't have my suit? That's the old way. You see what I'm saying? As we move in this living in harmony, wherever we go, people are better off as a result of us having passed by their way. Or the old way, they're all worse off as a result of us having encountered them during the day. And that's what we're trying to achieve here, is this transformation with ourselves. And the 10th step is how to live a day at a time. I'm going to spend some time on this, and then 11, 12 will be fairly quick. I would summarize it down to this. The secret to living a day at a time is staying undisturbed. That spiritual axiom, I think you brought it up, Polly. If something disturbs me, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with me. What's wrong with me? I'm disturbed. Disturbed means no contact with the higher power. The only contact we can have with our higher power is in the now. He doesn't exist anywhere else. We have to be totally in the now in order to have the wonderful support from our higher power. A disturbance takes us out of the now. So all we have to do in order to have a wonderful life is to stay undisturbed. Well, how am I going to stay undisturbed? All these things happen. There's a four-part thing in the 12 and 12 about how to do this. Part one, honest analysis of what's wrong. This is, boom, a disturbing event just happened. Honest analysis of what's wrong. How do I do that? Call up on the phone. Hey, this happened. How do you see it? What do you think's going on here? Blah, blah, blah. Honest analysis. Self-restraint. Self-restraint is something we pray for so that we do not react until we get undisturbed. When we react when we're disturbed, like the boss comes in and says, hey, that's a lousy memo you wrote. Well, screw you, I quit. And then, you know, the words are coming across the room to his ears, and I'm trying to get him back. I need the job. But he got me upset. And he says, I'll see ya. Damn. So self-restraint. My friend Ed Chandler from San Antonio, his trick is, as he's going out the front door, he lets five people be wrong ahead of time. And then a couple days a week, he has a little deal. Everybody can drive any way they want day. I go down the road, they go, hey, it's your free day. Drive anywhere you want. And then that proves to you, you don't have to freak out in traffic. I'm going to let everybody drive any way they want today. I'm just going to stay in the right lane and go, boop, 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 boop. Even if they go, what are you, a wimp? Yeah, I'm a wimp. But I'm a happy wimp. So undisturbed, self-restraint, so we don't... We never want to act until we get undisturbed again. Why? Because we're going to make a bad decision. Why would we want to make a decision when we're in a rage and then have to live with that? Undisturbed. So we have self-restraint, honest analysis of what's wrong. Two parts left. If it's our fault, we make an amend. If it's their fault, we forgive them. End of problem. We're back to being undisturbed. The end of the ball game. We win. The person who stays undisturbed is the winner. The person who's upset is the loser. And that is what this whole day at a time thing is. Staying undisturbed. At the end of the day, we can go back over the day and see where we could do it better. I can't imagine anything that would please a higher power more than one of his children looking back over the day, figuring out how they might do it better if they had the same situation tomorrow. You know, I could have been nicer to this. I could have done this. And then it'll start becoming part of us, where we're more interested in their well-being than ours. And that enhances our well-being more than anything we could possibly do. You can't get happier than that, which is to have no concern for your own happiness. I don't have to take care of me. My higher power is. Chuck Chamberlain, it's not your job to take care of yourself. That's God's job. Your job, go out and do God's work. Revolutionary. Unbelievable. Not my job to take care of me. No. Who told you your job to take care of you? Well, blah, 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 everybody. Well, that's non-spiritual approach. I'm going to tell you a compliment I got many years ago. It's the best compliment I ever got. I had a job... I had 18 years sobriety. I was broken. I finally got this job and then turned into a career and all that. I was a little tiny government agency. We regulated credit unions. I was in the general counsel's office. I was the congressional liaison, all these young lawyers. And, God, we had fun and we worked there. And after 10 years, I got hired away by the trade association. I've been gone about 3 years. But I would go back and have lunch with these guys. Some of them are still there. And one day we're at lunch. And the deputy general counsel, a guy named Jim, he just said this at lunch. He said, I'll tell you one thing. It stopped being fun to work here the day Sandy left. And I remember just going, whoa, I had that? I mean, what is that? And it was AA. It was somehow, it was joyful all the time, no matter what was going on. So at the end of this day thing, let's just take five more minutes. We're now with the promises in the ninth step where we make these amends. And I don't have time to talk about all the harm and everything. The end of the ninth step, the promises lead us into the tenth step. And in the big book it says, we're now entering the world of the Spirit. So the spiritual awakening has taken place. It describes what sobriety is like. It says we're no longer fighting alcohol. And if we're working on other character defects, we're no longer fighting them. This is not a question of willpower. This is a question of God power. It's a question of allowing ourselves to be helped in all areas rather than trying to accomplish anything on our own. And it says, we are no longer troubled by alcohol. We feel as if we've been placed in a position of neutrality. The problem doesn't exist for us. And it stays that way as long as we maintain our spiritual condition. It stays where we don't have to fight anything. So in other words, we don't learn how to be better at anything except getting help. It's, in other words, all I want to do is constantly receive help and be guided. If you were to ask me what I think God's will for me is, I'll tell you what I think it is. God would like to be intimately involved in every situation that I'm facing in order to provide me with the guidance to do it so that I'll always be happy and the power to carry it out. How's that? That's what I think God's will for me is. And now I'm going to be facetious. Unfortunately, he's very stingy with this help. He only, imagine this, he only gives this help when I ask for it. Other than that, he's stone quiet. Nothing. Well, I don't ask for it very often. And my ego notices that. My ego said, hey, Sandy, God only helped you twice last month. You think that's a loving God? I don't think so. I think you better keep that self-sufficiency. And so I'm struggling with that. Part of me doesn't want God involved. I want to be able to do it myself. The last part, and we all know what 12-step work is, so I'm not going to go into that. I'm just going to talk about prayer and meditation. This is when we stop the we program. And now it's up to me. Nobody can pray and meditate for me. This is an individual adventure. And Bill suggests in both the Big Book and the 12 and 12 that our libraries are filled with books and teachers about prayer and meditation. They're not conference approved. The libraries are filled. And you will be surprised if you went into Borders or someplace like that. This is after you've been around a while. And you just go browsing around in books on meditation or prayer or whatever and see if one of them doesn't jump out at you. And you look at an author and you see a sentence and you go, whoa, now you're on a little adventure. You're on, this is you. What are we doing? What are we trying? What's the last thing in chapter 5 that we read? What's the last word? Does anybody remember? Sought. Right? God could and would if he were sought. So let me close by discussing seeking. And see if any of us are at the level that we might want to be, because that's what we should become. Seekers. If we look, he will disclose himself to us. That's what we, so that's up to me. I can't have it. My group helped me seek. I've got to do that myself. The first time I ever heard seek was in grammar school. They said, we're going to play hide and seek. And I said, what's that? Well, one of the kids is going to hide and you find him. Oh, cool. So they ran and hid. Now I'm looking. And I go, look, 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 look. And I go, oh, I'm tired of that. I don't care if I ever find him. That's a very low level seeking. You know what I'm talking about? It's just like 3 minutes, seeking's over. Now, when it came to Easter baskets, oh, 5 pounds of chocolate. We got the seeking up here. My mother said, I'm going to hide the Easter bunny. You just look and look and look. And when you find it, you get to eat all that chocolate. Okay. Hey, 10 minutes. Am I warm? Am I close? Am I going, you know, I'm starting to lose it, even with chocolate. And finally I go, who gives a damn about that damn chocolate? I'm tired of looking. That's a medium level of seeking. Now, when I was about 14, we had a golden retriever who ran away. That dog was my life. And he was last seen going into those woods. Now, that dog never came back. But I'd hate to tell you how many years I stood on the edge of those woods and was looking and calling his name. I really wanted to find that dog. If we could get our level of seeking for our own higher power anywhere near that level, it'll change our whole lives. So if you're at that stage, you've been around AA for 20 years, and it kind of leveled off, become a seeker. You owe it to yourself. Thank you all very much.
Seems a shame to stop you. Time is wearing on. I'd like to ask Gemma to come up here just now. Thanks. Can I ask you to thank our speakers tonight? Pam from Arizona, Sandy from Tampa, and let's not forget Gemma. All three of them are here tomorrow morning. I don't know if we'll finish with a song then or not, but we're here at 9:30 tomorrow morning, and we look forward to seeing some, if not all of you. And what we'd like to do is to ask you to help me to close the meeting with a serenity prayer. Please. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Amen.